Is just war a contradiction in terms? Kirby Anderson considers the moral legitimacy of war now on Probe.
Can Christians support the idea of war? How far should we go in punishing evil? Well, these are questions we will address this week with the help of research by Probe Associate Lawrence Terlizzi. This is an important topic because Christians need to think biblically about this topic rather than being captive to the culture, and we need to discuss it because the topic is controversial. The Air Force suspended an ethics course on Christian just war theory that has been taught by its chaplains at Vandenberg Air Force Base for more than 20 years because the material included passages from the Bible. The challenge to the class was brought by the Military Religious Freedom Foundation that argued that the course violated the constitutional separation of church and state. The class was suspended the same day the complaint was filed. So this week we're going to talk about the just war tradition. It finds its source in several streams of Western thought: biblical teaching, law, theology, philosophy, military strategy, and common sense. Just war thinking integrates the wide variety of thought through providing Christians with a general orientation on the issues of war and peace. This tradition transcends denominational barriers and attempts to actually supply workable answers and solutions to very difficult moral problems. Just war has its origins in Greco-Roman thinking as well as Christian theology through Augustine, Aquinas, and Calvin, who have all contributed to its development. Now, just war thinking does not provide surefire ways of fighting guilt-free wars or offer blanket acceptance of government action. It often condemns acts of war as well as condones. Just war presents critical criteria, malleable enough to address a wide assortment of circumstances. It does not give easy answers to difficult questions. Instead, it provides a broad moral consensus concerning problems of justifying and controlling war. It presents a living tradition that furnishes a stock of wisdom consisting of doctrines, theories, and philosophies. So this week we'll talk about how to apply this just war tradition to the war on terror, and we'll learn about the distinction between holy war and just war. And finally, we'll talk about the various elements of this tradition that informs our decision to go to war and how to conduct a war. If you'd like more information about this topic, please visit the Probe website at www.probe.org/radio.
This has been Probe with your host, Kirby Anderson. If you think the just war tradition requires some more thought and consideration, get your free copy of Lawrence Terlizzi's transcript, Just War, today. Go to probe.org. Again, that's probe.org. And then join us next time as we shine God's light into our dark culture here on Probe.
To apply just war criteria, we must first have a reasonable assessment of current circumstances. You know, during the Cold War era, we witnessed a bipolar world actually consisting of two colossal opponents. The end of the Cold War has brought about the demise of strict ideological battles and has propelled the advent of cultural divisions in a multipolar world. Present and future conflicts exist along cultural lines. And this clash of civilizations paradigm replaces the old model of East versus West. People are more inclined to identify with their religious and ethnic heritage than old ideology. So the West has emerged as the global leader, leaving the rest of the world to struggle either to free itself from the West or to catch it economically and technologically. The triumph of the West has created a backlash in Islamic fundamentalism. Now, fundamentalism does not represent an ancient living tradition, but a modern recreation of ancient beliefs with a particular emphasis on political conquest. Fundamentalists do not hesitate to enter into a battle or holy war, known as a jihad, with the enemies of God at the political and military level. The tragic events of 9/11 and the continued struggle against terrorism traces back to the hostility Islamic fundamentalists feel towards the triumph of the West. They perceive the West as a threat and challenge to their religious beliefs and traditions, as many Christians actually feel threatened by the advance of modern secular society. The error for fundamentalism lies in thinking that it can recreate the past and enforce those beliefs and conditions on the modern world. Coercion remains at the heart of fundamentalist practice, consisting of a threat potentially worse than modern secular society. Now, this cultural divide causes Christians to reconsider the basis of warfare premised on the responsibility of the state to actually defend civil society against the encroachment of religious extremism that fights in the name of God or a holy cause or crusade. Now, this may sound strange at first to theological ears, but an absolute principle of just war states that Christians never fight for God and country, but only for country. There is only a secular and civil but necessary task to be accomplished in war, never a mandate to inaugurate God's kingdom. In this sense, just war thinking attempts to secularize war by which it hopes to limit its horrendous effects. An essential distinction divides just war from holy war. Just war does not claim to fight in the name of God or even for eternal causes. It strictly concerns temporal or political reasons. Roland Baton sums up this position by saying, "War is more humane when God is left out of it." This does not embrace atheism, but a Christian recognition concerning the value, place, and responsibilities of government. The state is not God or absolute, but plays a vital role in maintaining order and peace. The epistles repeat this sentiment in Romans 13 and other passages. Government does not act as an organ or defender through which God establishes his kingdom. Government does not have the authority to enforce God's will on unwilling subjects except within a prescribed and restricted civil realm that maintains the minimum civil order for the purpose of peace. Government protects the good and punishes the evil. Government serves strictly temporal purposes in order that we may lead a tranquil and quiet life in all godliness and dignity, 2 Timothy 2. God establishes civil authorities for humanity's sake, not his own. Therefore, holy war that claims to fight in the name of God or for eternal verities constitutes demonic corruption of divinely sanctioned civil authority. The following distinctions, I think, help separate holy war and just war beliefs. Holy war fights for divine causes in crusades and jihads to actually punish infidels and heretics and promote a particular faith. Just war fights for political causes to defend liberty and religious freedom. Holy war fights by divine command issuing from clerics and religious leaders. Just war fights through moral sanction. Holy war employs a heavenly mandate. Just war, a state mandate. Holy war is unlimited or total, and anything goes, and the enemy must be eradicated in genocide or brought to submission. Just war fights out of obedience to the state, which is never incontestable. Holy war fights offensive wars of conquest, while just war fights defensive wars generally responding to provocation. Holy war battles for God to enforce belief and compel submission. Just war defends humanity in protecting civil society, which despite its transitory and mundane role in the eternal scheme of things, plays an essential part in preserving humanity from barbarism and allows for everything else in history to exist. Just war thinking uses two major categories to measure the legitimacy of war. The first is one that actually looks at the reasons for war. This category asks questions to be answered before going to war. It has three major criteria: just authority, just cause, and just intent. Just authority serves as the presupposition for the rest of the criteria. It requires that only recognized state authorities use force to punish evil. Just war thinking does not validate individual actions against opponents, which would be terrorism, nor does it allow for paramilitary groups to take matters in their own hands. Just authority requires a formal declaration. War must be declared by a legitimate government authority. In the United States, Congress holds the right of formal declaration, but the president executes the war. Congressional authorization in the last 60 years has substituted for a formal declaration. Just cause is the most difficult standard to determine in a pluralistic society. Whose justice do we serve? Just war asserts the notion of comparative or limited justice. No one party has claim to absolute justice. There exists either more or less just cause on each side. Therefore, just war thinking maintains the right to dissent. Those who believe a war to be immoral must not be compelled against their wills to participate. Just war thinking recognizes individual conscientious objection. Just cause breaks down into other considerations. First, it requires that the state perform all its duties. Second, just cause requires proportionality. This means that the positive results of war must outweigh its probable destructive effects. The force applied should not create greater evil than that is resisted. And finally, just intent judges the motives and the ends of war. It asks, why go to war? What is the end result? Motives must originate from love, or at least some minimum concern for others, with the end result being peace. This rules out all revenge, and the goals of war aim at establishing peace and reconciliation. This week we've been talking about just war, and I certainly do encourage you to get more information about this by visiting the Probe website, probe.org/radio. This week we've been talking about just war tradition, and today I would like to look at how to conduct a war. The proper conduct in war, or judging the means of war, is the second category used to measure conflict, and it has two primary standards, proportionality and discrimination. Proportionality maintains that the employed necessary force not outweigh its objectives. It measures the means according to the ends and condemns all overkill. One should not use a bomb when a bullet will do. Now, discrimination basically means non-combatant immunity. A combatant is anyone who, by reasonable standards, is actively engaged in an attempt to destroy you. POWs, civilians, chaplains, medics, and children are all non-combatants and therefore exempt from targeting. Buildings such as hospitals, museums, places of worship, and landmarks share the same status. However, those previously thought to be non-combatants may forfeit immunity if they participate in fighting. If a place of worship becomes a stash for weapons and a safe house for opponents, it loses its non-combatant status. A proper understanding of discrimination does not mean that non-combatants may never be killed, but only that they are never intentionally targeted. The tragic reality of every war is that non-combatants will be killed. Discrimination attempts to minimize these incidents so that they become the exception rather than the rule. Killing innocent lives in war may be justified under the principle of double effect. This rule allows for the death of non-combatants if they were unintended and accidental. Their deaths equal the collateral effects of just intent. Double effect actually states that each action has more than one effect. Even though the one effect was intentional, the other is accidental. You know, given the ferocity of war, it is understandable that many may scoff at the notion of just war. However, just war thinking accepts war and force as part of the human condition, and it hopes to arrive at the goal of peace through realistic yet morally appropriate methods. It does not promote war, but seeks to mitigate its dreadful effects. Just war thinking morally informs Western culture to limit its acts of war and not to exploit its full technological capability, which could only result in genocide and total war.